Chapter 7. Digging for History. The experience of nations with well-being is exceedingly brief. Nearly all throughout history have been very poor. John Kenneth Galbraith, The Affluent Society, 1958. Today, we find the white guys getting hammered by the white guys, mainly middle-class twats. Yes, the do-as-I-say crowd is blaming all the world's ills on the Anglos, the European colonists, the free enterprise types, and your skin color is often the deciding factor as far as guilt is concerned. Forget those oppressing the Yiggers, though. As the son of a senator, Al Gore, might say, an inconvenient truth. Digging up the dirt for those with little else to think about, because they obviously don't think much at all, is easy. White equals sign slaver. The connection is simple, no need to engage the brain, and this newly legalized prejudice, unfortunately for all of us, works for a while. But what happens when we dig even deeper into history and uncover the bodies before the white supremacists arrived and burned their boats on the beaches, allied themselves with local tribes against other local tribes, and began to subjugate, infect, and enrich themselves off the previously enslaved survivors of the region's hard men? Look a little closer than a BLM supporter does at the communist leanings, supposed, of their leaders who now own multi-million dollar property portfolios, and you find the word slave comes from Slav. Yes, the white Slavs give us the name for slaves because they were the people most enslaved in Europe and the Muslim Empire, hundreds of years before the European colonial era. Maybe Serb and Russian victim groups can demand reparations from the Turks. After all, they ran the Ottoman Empire, the most recent raiders. Ancient Greece and Rome, and later feudal nations in Europe, were full of slaves, white ones. Their numbers? Many, many times those enslaved by the colonials, with the Roman Republic and Empire lasting almost 1,000 years. Tom Holland in Dominion, Holland 2019, opens with the use of terror by the Romans to keep the great multitude of these white scum in order, quoting Seneca on the inventive means by which naughty slaves were crucified. One perhaps upside down with his head towards the ground, another with a stake driven through his genitals, another attached by his arms to a yoke. The later European elites became more equal opportunity and diversity, recognizing oppressors, but only after they had learned in the 15th century how to navigate south of Morocco. And among these new expansionists, who owned the slaves? The poor in the fields? The uneducated masses allowed only one religion? No, the usual suspects, the rulers and influential people, with the peasants at home under the heel of these elites of their day, as our lives are limited and enthralled to our superconnected today. As recently as the 1840s, the typical Englishman was dirt poor. According to the economic historian Gregory Clark, his material standard of living was not much better than that of an average Roman slave. Nassar, 2011, Pieda Safen, Penelope and Rupert, let those words sink in, a slave. This a free man's probably lived in a single-room house and had a single set of clothes, and if he was lucky, he and his family did not work down the many mines needed to power the factories. Many others lived short, miserable lives, sucking in coal dust, hardly seeing sunlight, and dying desperately poor, with the vote eluding them for three or more generations. When Engels was in Manchester around the same time, the average lifespan of the Mancunians was just 17 years, with only half the children seeing in their fifth birthday. Nassar, 2011, p. 13. So why should the typical white English person today be treated by condescending, posh, and weak-minded ignoramuses as guilty by association of heinous crimes? A generation after enough decently off people voted to end the slave trade, our city dwellers were still dying off at an age that today sees their fortunate progeny still in school. Yet many of the kids with such animosity to their poor predecessors lead latte lives and swan off to punch great holes in the ozone layer, allegedly on gap year jaunts. Shouldn't Penelope be off chasing after the Mongolians for their rape and pillage past, as Genghis Khan's seed can be traced in about 16 million people today? Maybe Rupert can head off to Mauritania and stop the ongoing slaving there and save some ex-Muslims from terror, incarceration, and execution. Double bubble. These might be a little riskier than abusing statues in the shires, so I don't expect many of them will be getting the one-way ticket to Ulaanbaatar or Nouakchott. If they do, they have joined the frontline club, a small and exclusive one. Respect. I will not deny my ancestors. They struggled and lived desperate lives to carry us to this point, and I appreciate it. When it came to freeing black slaves, the UK's poorest were among the most vociferous campaigners, used to being rough-handled by the rich themselves, being press-ganged into the Royal Navy to face death and mutilation. They had some fellow feeling for other unfortunates. I do not appreciate those trying to demean me and criminalize my skin color. I thought that we had gotten past that, but not anymore thanks to the importation of shoddy American histories, poor critical thinking skills, and the snobbery of the collaborationist Brahmins among us. Is collective punishment perfectly reasonable to impose on Europeans hundreds of years after the crime, but not for Palestinians involved in recent bombings? Neither is right. It's a pathetic argument as well as a racist slur and should be treated as such. Even in the US, when the South broke from the North in their Civil War, most white Southerners did not own slaves. They were poor farmers and workers under the cosh of the rich too. Yes, the whites of those eras had their prejudices, carryovers from biblical texts talking about Ham and the role his black progeny were to fulfill. And as you will find, this still resonates, particularly in the Muslim world. However, the bloodiest war the Americans have fought eventually turned on the question of ending slavery, so I think it might be time to move on. Well, if no one else is, I'm sending back the faux guilt they are trying to palm off on me, as it's all a sham. Divide and rule. The oldest trick in the book. The next animosity inducer is already written into the playbook and will be thrown under the pot to keep it boiling when they need a little more fake hate to keep us from looking around and seeing what they are up to. You live once. Don't waste it hating and polishing your bitterness, particularly when you are being used, handled, and directed to destroy our democracies and our freedoms. Think about it. The news repeats the same quotes on dozens of channels. The same words are used, and the same imagery is poured into your brain. These are not accidents, they are parts of a strategy, and this is why I have not owned a television for over a decade. I can knock out divisive mind map plans in my sleep and produce a set of headings under which I can start a war, a revolution, or a peaceful campaign to see that the people get a veto. I prefer the latter, but some people don't. You and I are being gamed by time-served experts, with many dupes being used as fronts by the agency types. In both ancient Greece and Rome, prisoners of war and their own poor fell into slavery, with many being owned by the wealthy. The Roman latifundia were huge estates built up over generations, largely by taking farms off formerly independent farmers who never returned from their battles in the legion or who had fallen into debt, maybe having to work the same patch they once owned for its new owner, Grabius Maximus, a distant relative of one of our bankers. Up until 1861, whenever land was traded, Russian serfs were still sold alongside the owner's pigs, and before then, they were sold in huge numbers to the Ottomans, the white women being particularly popular, and the men maybe castrated. However, the aim of today's left and the corporate scamsters is not to make things too complicated, not to reflect reality. It is just to ram three-word slogans down the public's throat and to put their people in charge. They want power, and their vanguard parties and representatives want it now, foisting a recycled elite on the rest of us. Go ask the Chinese people about the CCP and the little red offspring of the senior party apparatchiks, owning companies galore, a fancy foreign university degree under their belts, and billions in foreign bank accounts. What do our corrupt central bankers do about this? Not a lot. Canadian truckers will have their accounts closed, but Chinese billionaires linked to the genocidal crew running the CCP can discuss their private equity arrangements with our trust fund bankers. None of these gutless and corrupt elites want to hear about this direct democracy stuff. All it will do is put a brake on the control freaks on the left and the central bankers on the wherever the money is. And these people know how to treat dissenters. Vasily Blokhin personally executed close to 40,000 enemies of the state for Stalin. He was only one such executioner with many thousands of dead in their little red logbooks. No other such ideology has produced individuals with these numbers to their credit, totalitarian ace of aces. The gilded woke want power, and the very last thing they want is the hybrid solution, a systemic means for us to have real power and to work together, ending their reign and their sick enjoyment of lording it over us. Now let's look at this scientifically. This will settle it, apparently. And we find that those murderous white Europeans came from Central Asia. Yes, old tombs on the steppe and DNA results from the bodies contained there link them to us. In fact, the Brits who built the first versions of Stonehenge were practically wiped out by the arrival of these horse-riding, wheel-inventing folk who had the cheek to remodel the place. Yes, Brits, largely, are surviving Central Asian marauders who colonized and eradicated most of the locals long ago, and we have been followed throughout history by more Central Asian tough guys disgorging from the east to ravage the west. Can we sue their descendants? Probably not. They are not famous for their guilt complex and deep, debt-fueled wallets. Do our students feel sorry for the Brits displaced to become Welsh and Scots? The latter gaining their name from an Irish immigrant tribe that obviously did rather well in their new abode. The DNA records show that our immigrant cousins depopulated areas of Europe of their menfolk, then settled down to enjoy the remaining womenfolk. Maybe the diseases they brought with them only killed the men. Ask a scientist how that might work. If we can look further back, where did this lot originate from? Can we go back and blame them too? This endless search will see us finding one bloke, gotta be a bloke, who caused all this mayhem. What to do if he originated in India? What if the DNA shows that the Central Asian types came out of India, an expansion of the survivors who first made it there in a previous out-of-Africa migration around 65,000 years ago? Logically, scientifically even, that would mean that the Europeans are Aryan survivors from the subcontinent, possibly those in the Hindu legends, no? We have our similarities, as Gandhi said in Hind Swaraj. It would be folly to assume that an Indian Rockefeller would be better than the American Rockefeller. Gandhi, 1910, p. 108. Did we get our European class system from them? It is a bit like the caste system. Who knows? Who cares? We can endlessly dissect the past and point fingers instead of just getting along, as most of us do. But if you want to rule, if you want to keep us divided and distracted, then keep digging up the past and selectively mining it for explosive materials. I suggest we stop shoveling with evil intent and start living. It is time to concentrate on our controllers, not our colors, and to take the reins of power in our hands, once and forever. The powerful of all tribes and nations seem to have enjoyed being in charge and sneering at the lower orders, slaughtering them when they revolted, like Spartacus and the tens of thousands of slaves in their battles with Rome, and the black slaves hunted down by their Muslim masters in the Sand Rebellion, or the thousands of peasants cut down in our great revolt in the 14th century and in Germany's war against their low life in the 16th. So the top white Brit elites weren't the only buggers up to this. They have been at it everywhere. Let's look at the world's largest democracy. Bhimrao Ambedkar, an untouchable, or Dalit, as they are referred to today, rose to oversee the committee writing India's massive constitution, published an interesting book about the Shudras, Ambedkar, 1946, the lowest of the four castes, Varnas, among the Hindus. Ambedkar shows how the Shudras, or menials, who formed the mass of the Indian population under the Brahmins, or priests, the Kshatriyas, or soldiers, and the Vaishyas, or traders, were not allowed to be educated. Stop. Yes, you read that right. In fact, it was a sin and a crime to give them education for millennia. Ambedkar, 1946, piece of 44, no Eton and an Oxbridge PPE for this lot. That was not the worst of it for them, as Ambedkar pointed out, Ambedkar 1946 Piyads 37, a tiny selection only. A. According to the Brihaspati Smriti, a Shudra teaching the precepts of religion or uttering the words of the Veda or insulting a Brahmin shall be punished by cutting out his tongue. B. According to the Gautama Dharma Sutra, now if he listens intentionally to a recitation of the Veda, his ears shall be filled with molten, tin, or lac. If he recites Vedic texts, his tongue shall be cut out. If he remembers them, his body shall be cut in twain. The Dalits, the poorest group, from which Dr. Ambedkar himself rose to become India's top lawyer, didn't even make the cut into the caste system. They are true outcasts. Hundreds of millions of these desperately poor people still live on the periphery of life, on the edge of villages, towns, and cities across India. In recent decades, some have become successful commercially and otherwise, thankfully, but the situation is still dire for the vast majority. When partition happened in 1947, Pakistan and its Muslims wanted to retain some non-Muslims, the Dalits. They were useful and acceptable to those in the new Islamic Republic, as Arundhati Roy noted, to shovel their shit. Roy, 2016, p. 63. As an untouchable, Ambedkar was unusually lucky, receiving an education because a decent ruler in his home state, Baroda, set aside some funds for outcasts to be schooled. Ambedkar is a great advert for the poor everywhere, too often demeaned by the mirror-admiring elite, as he rose to earn a PhD in the US and another in the UK on the way to becoming independent India's first law and justice minister. However, today you still won't find many of his fellow unfortunates filling university chairs as professors, let alone cabinet posts. They are often in sewage tanks and dying young from the diseases they acquire. Even the large contingent of Marxist lecturers running the universities don't appear to want to make much room for the Dalits, maybe because most of the champagne socialists are Brahmins. Some people are literally beyond the pale, even to a good commie. To be fair to the Brahmins, many of them are now poor, partly because the complicated positive discrimination laws favoring the lower castes are reducing the opportunities for the once all-powerful elite. This again shows that they have no innate and outstanding gifts with which to rise, that they too would benefit from being equal under the law, as should be the case. The hybrid solution is designed to treat all of us the same, and must come with constitutional protections concerning equality of opportunity, not outcomes, so that the vote of the majority cannot eradicate the equal rights of a minority. However, in the end, it is real tolerance that counts, and Switzerland and the hybrid democracy has set the standard in this regard, as will be shown later. While we are on India, the white Brits did do terrible things there. However, once again, the elites of that time were the instruments, just as the Indian upper castes, in the past, abused the lower castes. The same power elite that had happily slaughtered British peasants in feudal times and counted the profits from the triangular trade were the ones who were also happy to profit from wheat shipped west that was still much needed in India. when India was ravaged by terrible famines in the 18th and 19th centuries, in which close to 30 million died, wheat was still regularly exported, even though administrators knew the outcome of doing so. White, 2012, pp. 309, 315. Our wonderful leaders did the same to the Irish in the 1840s as well, and though the numbers involved were less, the effect on a smaller population was devastating. Blair deserves, for this at least, some kudos for doing what he could to make amends. Is it any wonder that the Irish and Indians were so eager to see the back of Britain? The Indian famines show why the likes of Subhash Chandra Bose and his Indian troops chose to fight alongside the Japanese in World War II, and that in the 1840s, why the Irish later sought arms from the Kaiser. It was also this desire to be their own masters that played a significant part in the Indian Navy mutinies after the war, and these expedited the British exit and partition of the subcontinent. However, the elites in India and Ireland have as much to learn today as do the Oxbridge crew in the UK. We are all supposed to be in this together, allowing the people to run the democracies that they thought they had earned with their sacrifices. Unfortunately, it appears that the only way to do so in India, Ireland, or the UK today is by adopting the hybrid democracy and not continuing down the representative path that the crooked and corrupt wish us to continue treading. Why would they want change? They are already enjoying the road to riches. But also, they should take note, future infamy. Charles Darwin is an intellectual hero of mine, however, a regrettable side to his discoveries and his views on race was the justification that these were thought to give for the actions of colonialists and eugenicists in the leading, though not in moral terms, nations of the West. Lindqvist, 2012, pp. 260, 261. Our supremacist attitude at that time matched that of earlier conquerors, ignoring the objections by some decent individuals in our midst to the treatment of the conquered. However, most of the elites in the Victorian and Edwardian eras often justified colonial conquests and bloodbaths by citing Darwinian ideas or claiming to be saving souls and spreading civilization. Practice often belied the claims. As in the Belgian Congo, King Leopold's forces are thought to have killed up to 10 million Africans, a fate a lot worse than the depredations of the abusers and slavers they were saving some of them from. Naturally, the losses across the continent were always more considerable for the conquered than for the Maxim machine gun funders intent on spreading the benefits of their wisdom. Technology can do that for you, and raw courage can do nothing about it. This is still the case today, but now the technology is being turned on the free folk in the democracies too. Hence, the urgency and the commitment needed from us all to deal with things before we no longer can. You have got to be prepared to stand, as the Hong Kong people have, as the Chinese have tried on occasion, and we must grab back our rights too. We must use our votes and the forces inside our establishment that support us, even if keeping their heads down now, to improve democracy in our own backyard. Then we can inspire and support those with no chance of survival without us. We have done this before and must dig deep once more to keep the standard aloft and hope alive. As the old boy used to say, never give in. Never. The colonists did eventually end the slave trade, even where it had existed for many centuries before they took over. Sub-Saharan West Africa had been the hunting ground of Muslim slavers and traders for almost 1,000 years prior to the whites bowling up. The victims were sometimes prisoners of war taken in a local conflict between murderous rulers, but as the transatlantic slave market grew to compete with that of the Muslims, capturing people purely for the Atlantic trade became more common. Once more, the masses were terrorized into subjugation by local and expatriate psycho-strongmen, eager for more power, riches, and women. Slaves were also taken by local tribes as sacrificial victims, servants, and concubines. Others were sold to the Muslim slavers penetrating from the north, where they served mainly as domestic servants, bedmates, and eunuchs. Jihad in West Africa by Paul E. Lovejoy gives a detailed account of the trade, with gold and slaves being the goods most transported north. By the 10th century, hardy Muslim businessmen had begun converting many of the leading dynasties in the savannah country, but they left the masses to continue with their local forms of worship, keeping a ready supply of non-believers to capture and sell. The harvesting raids on these black subsistence farmers would generally be led by Muslim Berber traders and local converts, ruthlessly killing most of the men and leading off the women and children for use by their captors or to be sent on the deadly trek to the slave markets in the Islamic caliphates. Many of the surviving men would be castrated prior to being taken to the slave markets, as such mutilation was not approved of under their laws. Death very often resulted from the rudimentary surgery, as this required cutting off the entire genitalia, and many millions must have died from this over the centuries, from the raids, and from their passage across the sands. Some tried to run, even from remote desert slave markets deep in the Sahara, such as in Salah in today's Algeria. When found and captured, they had their testicles crushed, their Achilles tendons slashed, then were left behind. Lindqvist, 2012, p. 168. Once more we find elites crushing the weak, the poor, and the defenseless, even keeping them outside of the religion, so that they would be suitable targets for their raiding, forever. Is that okay? Because the killers, the castrators, and the rapists were not white? The numbers concerned are considerably more than those inflicted upon the Africans by the white slavers. The Arabs and Muslim traders dominated East Africa and eventually the interior for almost 2,000 years, whilst the grasping whites only reached the region in the late 1400s to establish their trading posts along the coast, to which the African traders would bring in their prisoners from the hinterland. Reliance on Africa's local tribes and traders is made clear in Martin Meredith's The Fortunes of Africa, a 5000-year history of wealth, greed, and endeavor. Yet the trade depended on the collaboration of African rulers and middlemen, all of whom made their own profits from it. European traders were confined for the most part to fortified posts on the coasts or river estuaries, factories as they were known, built to protect them from European rivals. Rarely did they venture more than a few miles inland. They possessed no military power to force Africans to engage in any type of trade in which their leaders did not wish to participate. The business of selling slaves remained largely under African control. Meredith, 2014, p. 120. The white and black slave trading families often intermarried and made fortunes together. Lovejoy, 2016, p. 143. In the 6 decades after the banning of the slave trade, over 1,500 Royal Navy sailors would perish on anti-slavery duties, but they also saved over 150,000 slaves from 1,600 slave ships that they captured. Murray, 2023, p. 122. They effectively ended the worldwide trade before it blossomed again in our time, with the re-establishment of open slave markets and private prisons in Libya. Cole, 2017. BLM, any comments on this? Maybe the National Union of Students in the UK can arrange rolling protests outside the Libyan embassy. Any takers? Thomas Clarkson is a name not mentioned much these days, but he was the founder of the global movement to end slavery. This was a feat never applauded by the Muslim world, nor by many African tribal leaders of that era. Lovejoy, 2016, p. 160. In the late 18th century, Muslims in West Africa had become concerned that people of their faith were being sold to European slavers, and these captive Muslims were then being shipped off to the Americas. Enslaving non-Muslims is legal under all of Islam's codes of law, but Muslims never, never shall be slaves. Lovejoy, 2016, pp. Was 62, 67, 209, 212. A bit like those Brits in the famous song Rule Britannia, written about sailors and coastal dwellers in Britain being taken in slave raids by Muslims from the Barbary coast. To ensure that they controlled the slave trade and avoided Muslims being taken, West African Muslim religious leaders began a jihad to subjugate the interior and ensure that the faithful were not being sold to the Christians. The jihad succeeded in its aims by enslaving many millions of local non-Muslims, along with Muslims that they chose not to recognize as such, much as ISIS and others have done in our time. Estimates suggest that up to half the 10 million people in the Sokoto Caliphate were slaves, making it the largest slave-holding entity in the world during the 19th century. By the middle of the 19th century, there were more slaves in Muslim areas of West Africa than in all parts of the Americas at any time in the history of the Black Atlantic. Lovejoy, 2016, p. 160. Slaveholding continued into the 20th century, and today we see Sharia being enforced across the region, with Boko Haram running riot and taking girls as sex slaves for the new jihadis carrying on the old traditions. But the slaving of black Africans began long before their neighbors became Muslims. A Greek merchant seaman living in a Red Sea port around 80 CE wrote a guide to the East African coast to the south of where he lived, but also briefly included some general political details. The inhabitants of the coast were apparently of Negroid race, since they were of a very great stature, and living under a tribal system, since there were separate chiefs for each place. But these native chieftainships, it appears, had long been under some form of Arab suzerainty. They exported ivory in great quantity, rhinoceros horn, tortoise shell, and a little palm oil. The coast near Ras Hafun produces, says our author, slaves of the better sort, which are brought to Egypt in increasing numbers. Coupland, 1938. It wasn't until almost two millennia later that Arab rule over much of that coast ended. An ex-Muslim academic and leading proponent of interfaith dialogue, John Alimbilla Azuma, comments on the trade in the legacy of Arab Islam in Africa. He made it clear that the Muslim world still takes the curse of Ham to heart. Azuma, 2001, p. 168. We then outlined the traditional Muslim understanding and justification for enslavement, that is, non-belief in Islam. In addition to the content of their beliefs, black Africans were further placed under the burden of a mythological curse, which fettered them to perpetual servitude on account of the color of their skin. Thus, we demonstrated that contrary to conventional theories of the egalitarian spirit of Islam, light-skinned Muslims are just as color-conscious and racist as any other modern light-skinned society. Racial discrimination against Africans and people of African descent in medieval Muslim sources and modern light-skinned societies are just as endemic. We then outlined how Muslims, from the pious to the nominal, within and without Africa, waged jihad, raided, hunted, kidnapped, and purchased tens of millions of Africans as slaves, and in the process slaughtered and caused the death of tens of millions others. Interestingly, a footnote records that in 1997, Yasmin Alibhai Brown, a famous British anti-racist Muslim, carried out a random survey for a show on the BBC which revealed that Asians, mainly Pakistani Muslims in this case, most resented mixed marriages with blacks. Azuma, 2001, p. 138. Not something they will be discussing in the social engineering and transitioning lessons in a primary school near you. Balance is not required when pushing an ideology and subverting a democracy, in fact, just the opposite. Did I mention that Maggie stopped MI5 investigating subversion back in the 1980s and Blair fiddled around with the death penalty for treason in the 2000s? That worked for the subverters, but not for the rest of us. In my opinion, our top tier shows a lot more rot than the bottom, another self-evident reason for supporting hybrid democracy. But it wasn't only the slaves in Africa who suffered from the whites and the Muslims. From the very first days of the rapid Arab conquests across the Middle East, west through North Africa to Spain, and east through Central Asia to India, the locals suffered grievously. The Hindu Kush means the graveyard of the Hindus, and it earned the name because so many enslaved Hindus died crossing the mountains on their way to lives as slaves in Muslim Central Asia and the Arab caliphates. But that's ignored by the guilt-tripping pillocks in universities and hipster-friendly corporations across the West. Islamic law demands conversion by those they conquer who are not people of the book, that is, not Jews and Christians. When the Muslims conquered lands with Zoroastrians, Berbers, and Hindus, their fate was sealed: convert or die, again as required by the Sharia. This was later watered down because retention of the old killing code would have required the slaughter of countless millions of refuseniks and potential taxpayers. However, Muslim historians did like to record the tens of millions killed over the centuries by the various conquerors and subjugators, piling high the skulls of the slaughtered Hindus, Jains, and Buddhists in India in particular. Like the Europeans, most of these Muslim invaders of the subcontinent originated in Central Asia's steppe, the age-old story of the quiet farmer being subjugated by the remote area hardened warrior. The Jews and Christians were not technically required to convert, but they were required to submit as conquered peoples living, on sufferance, under a pact, a dhimma. They thus became known as dhimmis, living unarmed, unprotected from general abuse, and over the centuries worn down and morally crushed. Vestiges remain in Egypt in the form of the Copts, but across North Africa, they are all gone. A particularly righteous group of Berber warriors, the Almohads, offered the dhimmis the choice of death, conversion, or expulsion. Bertrand, 1956, PERS 126. Technically, conversion is not required of dhimmis under Sharia, but on this occasion, that was the choice offered. Again, not something you're going to hear much about on the BBC, but the facts are indisputable and recorded by their own historians. Letourneau, 1969, pp. 57-58. The point being made here is that which Richard Wrangham and Dale Peterson expressed in Demonic Males, Apes and the Origins of Human Violence. Wrangham, Richard Patterson, Dale, 1996. All these events took place before European colonists and imperialists showed up on the horizon, making clear that patriarchy and all things oppressive do not uniquely arise out of our white skin or our culture. Wrangham was a professor of anthropology at Harvard University when he and Peterson noted the evidence that, despite the admirable intentions of those who believe that patriarchy is solely a cultural invention, there is too much contrary evidence. Patriarchy is worldwide and history-wide, and its origins are detectable in the social lives of chimpanzees. It serves the reproductive purposes of the men who maintain the system. Patriarchy comes from biology in the sense that it emerges from men's temperaments out of their evolutionarily derived efforts to control women and at the same time have solidarity with fellow men. Wrangham, Richard, Patterson, Dale, 1996, p. 125. So, white skin and European culture are not the causes of blokes dominating history. Our shared prehistory probably has something to do with it. Muslims are not fans of evolutionary science. So many will not accept Wrangham's conclusions. But the violence-prone, demonic, and dominating male is not the result of a racial or civilizational spark, but is much more ancient and common. Again, as they wrote back in 1996, the violence, cruelty, and destructiveness of Western societies are clear, but such vices are not so distinctively Western. Islam, to consider yet another alternative, looks approximately as patriarchal, bellicose, and expansionist as Christianity. The great prophet and patriarch Muhammad himself was a warrior, and unlike Christ, called for spreading the faith by sword, the jihad, or holy war, to be advanced against anyone defying the will of Allah. By the middle of the 9th century, patriarchal Muslim states throughout the Mediterranean and Middle East were retaining their shape as best they could with the help of a slave warrior class largely acquired from Turkish peoples to the east. Wrangham, Richard Patterson, Dale, 1996, p. 118. Once more, we see the intolerance of a ruling elite, this time based upon conformance to their religion, whereas we see the reverse today with the CCP and the Uyghurs. Whilst I am on the subject of the Chinese, they were rulers in Vietnam for 1,000 years, eventually being booted out in 939 CE by the predecessors of the Viet Minh and the Viet Cong. Britannica, 2022. Despite over a millennium of sinicization, this shows that local people can still revolt against the imposition of a foreign culture, starting Vietnam on the path to earning its great title as the graveyard of empires. You should be aware that I do not feel any guilt for what others from my island did before I was born. I also feel that those from other countries that took or take no part in atrocities should feel no guilt either. Should we crucify the modern Germans looking into their history books to see what Hitler did? I know that many feel guilt even today, but that is a personal issue as no guilt whatsoever attaches to them as individuals. Nor should we blame the black Africans who took no part in slave trading in West Africa with the Muslims and for over 2,000 years in East Africa with the Arabs and others. The greedy commercial elites of all eras and of all cultures have proven to be the home, too often, of the conscienceless. More recently, these scumbags were joined by the lefty, proletarian dictatorship lovers who are equally unsuited to looking after any people's interests. We are on this planet together, so let's demand the hybrid solution and set humanity free from this dangerous and senseless division. The hybrid solution has been trialed now for almost 2 centuries and has proven itself better than any other form of government. It doesn't matter whether they be stable representative democracies or gulag-dependent dictatorships. Our representative democracies are in fact oligarchy-controlled shams, and the gulag-prone dictatorships need no further comment. So, do you want to live forever free or in bug-munching misery?